And we are at the top of the hour now, so I would like to introduce our speakers. Pardon me. For part one, speaking first is Dr. Eli Perencevich. He is the director at the Center for Comprehensive Access and Delivery Research and Evaluation, also known as CADRE, and that's in Iowa City VA healthcare system. And he's also a professor of internal medicine at the University of Iowa Carver College of Medicine. Speaking second is Dr. Austin Fracht. He is a health economist at the Healthcare Financing and Economics, known as HCFE, and that's in VA Boston Healthcare System. And he's also an associate professor of psychiatry and an associate professor of health policy and management here at the Boston University. So at this time, I would like to turn over to Dr. Perencevich. Are you ready to share your screen? Oh, let me unmute you first. There we go. Okay, you should see that pop up now on your screen. Great, thank you. Oh, Eli, it looks like you did figure out how to mute yourself, so if you can unmute, that would be great. You may have done it right there on the control panel itself. There we go.
There we go. Okay, sorry. Thank you. Thanks for the introduction, and thanks for allowing me to speak to you. This is an unusual talk for me, speaking about social media, usually talking about data, but sometimes it's fun to talk about communicating your science, and so that's the point of my talk. I'm an infectious disease physician, and I've spent the past 15 or so years studying hospital-acquired infections and trying to advance the research agenda for preventing resistant bacteria spreading in hospitals. So this is kind of part of my journey of why I use social media and how I use social media. So just an overview, one of the big issues when you're trying to both read the literature and follow it and keep up with it, but also communicate the science that you're producing in your lab is overcoming what's called publication overload. Publication overload is an issue for all of us, and so, you know, how do we stay up to date with the latest literature, and how do I advance my lab science to influence public health and public health policy, especially when you're someone like me in the middle of the country in Iowa. I don't engage with leaders, D.C. And big coastal cities, and so our lab has to get the word out somehow. So this is kind of a talk about how I use Twitter and why I blog about our science. So first is a poll question.
Thank you. Pardon me. Thank you. So up on our attendees' screens now, you will see our first poll question. Which social media platforms do you use regularly? Or if you use a number of them, which do you use most often? The first selection is that you blog, perhaps on Blogger or WordPress. You use Facebook. You use Twitter and Facebook, or you are not actively using social media at this time. Looks like we've got a nice responsive group. We've already had 75% of our audience vote, and the answers are still streaming in, so we will give people a little bit more time. So again, you just click that circle right next to your answer option. Great. We've had over 80% of our audience vote, so I'm going to go ahead and close the poll and share the results with you now. So as you can see, only 2% of our audience currently blogs, 43% uses Facebook, 2% uses Twitter, 38% Twitter and Facebook, and 16% are not actively using social media. Thank you for those replies, and we're back on your slides.
Okay. So this is kind of the kind of what you see when you look at adoption of social media, and so overall in the U.S., Pew did a survey last September 2014 of internet users over 18. So this is maybe slightly biased to those that use the internet, but 71% use Facebook, 28% use LinkedIn or Pinterest. 26% Instagram and 23% Twitter. And you can see Facebook use, obviously it's the highest, but it's leveling off, but all the other platforms are increasing quite quickly. And then similar to what the audience reported, Facebook, again, is the most frequently used daily and weekly. 87% of folks use Facebook at least weekly. And for Twitter, it's 60% of those that use Twitter use it daily or weekly. So there's a lot of use. And also, the survey reported that 52% of those use more than one social media platform. So much like many in the audience use Twitter and Facebook, that's seen throughout those that use the Internet. So that's the social media landscape. And here's kind of the other landscape that I like to look at is this is the publication overload issue. And this is Medline articles that have been published annually. In 1950, you can see it was 82,000. And then it took 20 years to approximately double. In 1970, it was 218,000. Another 20 years, it doubled to 406,000. And then in 2000, you can see it's 529,000. And by 2012, it had doubled again to over a million. So the doubling time is increasing, and you can see that almost like exponential publication growth. So how do you, you know, overcome this if you're a clinician like me and you want to stay up to date on the latest infectious disease literature and the hospital epidemiology literature or internal medicine literature or health economics literature? It's quite overwhelming. This is kind of one of my favorite shots. There's an old medical humor website I may or may not have been involved with 15 years ago. And one of the shots we had on there was this kind of screen of a pile of, you know, a live capture of a pile of journals. And so that was one way of keeping up. You get a ton of journals that pile up on your desk or on your shelf. And, you know, Journal Watch, you can also do subscription services and pay someone to search the literature for you. And a couple months after the articles come out, you'll get a Journal Watch, and I subscribe to Infectious Disease Journal Watch. They'll tell me the latest articles of importance, and that does save time, but it's not very quick, not that immediate, and so, you know, there are other ways. And so that's why I use, you know, why and how I use Twitter. Personally, I use it to stay up to date on the latest publication. So I not only subscribe to colleagues in my field, but also that post, so you can follow JAMA or various journals, and they'll tweet their latest articles that are published. But what I've really liked is, you know, I follow colleagues that I know in the field, and they post the latest articles, or I post them, and we retweet and favorite each other's tweets and discuss them with comments. You know, in our field, one of the big things that happened a couple days ago is Cubist made basically one of the only pharmaceutical companies that is even doing antibiotic discovery. We haven't had new antibiotics in 30 or 40 years, and so they're one of the few pharmaceutical companies that were doing that based in Boston. They were bought by Merck in January, and over the weekend they closed their entire antimicrobial discovery unit. And so there was a lot of activity on Twitter discussing that. So it was nice to be involved and discuss what people thought the implications were. Another thing, and I'll show you in a slide in a little bit, is what's called a Twitter Journal Club or Twitter Chat. And so I subscribe to several of those where we have a specified time where one discussant will select an article and present its findings and then open it up to Twitter for real-time discussion, and I really enjoyed those. And then another way to keep up with the literature is to follow national and international meetings. For example, in my field, you could follow ID Week or CROI, which is the retroviral HIV meeting. So Twitter's becoming big enough or used quite frequently in infectious diseases and medicine in general. And so this just was published a few weeks ago online in Clinical Infectious Diseases, which is the major infectious disease journal published by IDSA. And Deborah Goff, a pharmacist at Ohio State, and Jason Newland, infectious disease physician in Kansas City, published this article about kind of how and why to use Twitter. And you can tell probably they wouldn't publish this if the answer was it's a waste of time. They really went out of their way to show the benefits. One of the things I like about the article for those that are new is this figure or table here that they included telling you how to get started on Twitter. And obviously you go to the website, you create a short username that's easy to remember. Mine's at Eli Iowa, E-L Iowa, actually. So the shorter the better, because if you have a long username, it'll use up your 140 characters and it'll be harder for people to CC you on things. Upload a photo of yourself. A lot of people don't like to follow people that are just the egg image. So, you know, even if it's not a direct photo of yourself, maybe of something you like your favorite bird or cat. Something like that is more social than just a standard photo. You write a short description of yourself and identify yourself. I don't identify myself as being from the VA because I don't want to speak for the VA. And I, you know, carefully put that there and also on my blog. But I do say I'm an infectious disease physician and epidemiologist in what I study. I follow a lot of other healthcare providers, so that's the next thing to do. And also science journalists are good to follow, especially those that are in your field. Follow organizations and journals and then send your first tweet. Hopefully some people will follow you back. It's good to be social. If someone follows you, you follow them back and you create relationships, which I can describe a bit in a second. And, you know, if you do this long enough, I've been using Twitter for 3 or 4 years, you actually end up in a table. This is probably the first time I've ended up in a table in a medical journal. But so they listed me and my Twitter name and my Twitter profile. And so this is one way other people have been following me now that this article has been published. People have started following me from the IDSA. So as I mentioned, one of the things I really enjoy are Twitter journal clubs. So this one is just an example of one I'm involved with. It's ID Chat, and it's every Wednesday at 9 o'clock. Certain times of the year we cut back on it, particularly over the summer. But it's a weekly chat. We decide who's going to cover an article, and then we discuss it. And it's just like a regular journal club, but virtual. So it pulls in a lot of folks. Typically in infectious disease journal club in my hospital, it's just ID physicians and fellows and some medical students maybe. What's nice about ID Chat is it draws in general internists, infectious disease pharmacists, and others that are interested in the growing field of antibiotic resistance and infectious disease. So really have enjoyed that. Another thing, as I mentioned, that I really enjoy about Twitter is following live comments about what's going on at national meetings. So this is a particular meeting. It's the annual assembly of the American Academy of Hospice and Palliative Medicine and Hospice and Palliative Nurses Association that Steve Ash was at. I was not at this meeting, but he was live tweeting with photos of the slides and his comments based on the slides. And sometimes you know there's going to be a big presentation, your colleagues are there, you're not able to attend. So it's really nice to be able to follow the hashtag and follow the meeting. So another thing, I'm a scientist and I have a lab with 6 or 7 other faculty and VA investigators. And we want people to read our papers, but again, similar to the difficulty with reading and staying up with the literature, how do you get your paper noticed when you publish it? I'm not big on press releases. A lot of science journalists I've talked to at Science Online and other conferences that I've attended say they don't actually like to write about articles where they've done press releases on because they think they're biased. They would rather get the data looking themselves or getting it naturally from the scientists. So if there are, 800,000 or a million papers a year, your single paper that you're just published and you're really proud of, if it's not in the New England Journal or in JAMA or in Science, not many people will hear about it because it's, 0.00125% of all papers each year. There are over 2,000 papers published a day. So why would they even see your paper? And so this is why I feel like folks who lead a lab like I do should be have a blog, be involved in social media, and use both of these platforms to network with science journalists to leverage traditional media outlets. And I'll kind of tell you my story here over the next couple minutes before I pass it over to Austin about our blog that we started in 2009. So three of us, Dan DiCama, who was at University of Iowa at the time, Mike Edmond, who was at VCU, and I was at the University of Maryland, started an infection control blog called Controversies in Hospital Infection Control. And so kind of a wonky name. But now we're all in Iowa, so perhaps starting a blog is a recruitment tool. I'm not sure if that's ever happened before. But it brought us all together here to Iowa. And I think looking back at it, and I'll show a little bit more of the blog, but one of the keys was we had a focused, kind of narrow topic. And so people who were in the field or journalists who were interested in antibiotic resistance and hospital infections knew who to follow. And we stuck to what we knew. We very rarely went off topic. So we were recognized experts, and people, for some reason, cared what we had to say. But one of the other key things with this blog is it wasn't a single person blogging. It was great to have a team because people like to follow blogs that are frequently updated, and so we try to each write a post a week or so, and so there's always something there to look at, brings people in as an audience. Another thing is we're tenured professors, so there's perhaps less risk. I know folks kind of in this area who are assistant and associate professors who are a little concerned about how this would be perceived by promotion tenure committees. I'm very much in favor of it for them because it'll improve folks reading their papers and increase their profile, but it's still early in this emergence of social media, and so I can see why people wouldn't want to, and I didn't until I was a professor. And what's another thing is we never or pretty much rarely discuss our home institution, including the VA. My other two colleagues are not affiliated with the VA, and they'll comment on VA work much more frequently than I will. I almost never, perhaps once, which I'll tell you about, commented about the VA. So just a couple examples of how we've used the blog and Twitter to advance studies in areas we find important. So can we change public policy with our science? And the answer is no if no one reads your science. And so this paper here we publish in an open access journal that's a BMC journal called Antimicrobial Resistance and Infection Control. And this study looked at 3 years of NIH funding, 2007 to 2009, and found that there was almost no funding for antibiotic resistance and hospital-associated bacterial pathogens. Now, when we did this study, we tried to get it published in the main infectious disease journals, but there was a lot of bias against this because we compared it to funding for other pathogens like HIV. And we got comments back that, the reason there's no funding is there are no good people studying bacteria, things like this. So it was hard, and so I contacted a colleague who was starting a journal, and this was in the first ever issue of a journal no one ever knew about. Now it's pretty widely known in the field, but in 2012 when he started the first open access journal in our area, no one was reading it, and this is the fifth ever article published in it. So, how would anyone even see this article? And of course we blogged about this and tweeted about it, and Maren McKenna, who's the science journalist who covers our area, hospital-acquired infections and antibiotic resistance, has a book out called Superbug, where she writes about MRSA, methicillin-resistant Staph aureus, and has a blog on Wired, where she frequently writes about antibiotic resistance. And because of Twitter and our blog, she picked up on our article, and had this really nice post about how much is a drug resistance death worth. So we spend perhaps $68,000 annually for every person that dies of HIV in the country, but only about $570 studying MRSA, which kills the same number, so $570 per death. So millions spent on, tens of millions on Staph aureus and billions spent on HIV, so there's quite a discrepancy. Several in the field took this the wrong way, maybe saying we wanted to decrease HIV funding. We want all funding to be, you know, we want all our funding to equal HIV funding, not by bringing them down, by bringing it up. And she did a great job explaining that also. So it was really great that she picked up this little paper. And again, no one would ever read it, but now journals track metrics. And so you can see this paper that was published in the first ever batch of papers in this journal no one knew about is now labeled highly accessed, and over 8,000 people have read this paper. It's been quoted in the New York Times and various other sources, including JAMA commentaries and papers. And, you know, I'm not going to say this one paper did anything, but the field, the world has started to recognize we need to spend more money on antibiotic resistance. And, of course, the president just released his 2016 budget, and it includes over $1.6 billion now for antibiotic resistance research and prevention measures. So really big win for our field. You know, I'm not sure where this will end, and, you know, the, if these sorts of things don't always get approved, but still first time ever that something like this has made it this far. A couple other ways we've used the blog, influencing a national debate. So this is a big outbreak at NIH in 2011 where the NIH Clinical Center was getting hammered in the press. 18 and eventually 19 patients died, and the press was hammering them, saying they're not doing enough. There's a list there. They were doing everything possible, but the fact was there were no antibiotics to treat this infection, CRE, carbapenem-resistant Enterobacteriaceae. And so it's pan-resistant to all antibiotics, and we have no research to tell us how to prevent its spread. So I wrote this post saying you're going to, you know, slaughter the hospital epidemiologists doing their best, doing all these things, but not pay for research. You know, you kind of get what you pay for. It's not their fault, basically. So I was defending colleagues, none that I really knew personally, but just felt I could be in their situation. And this led to my little blog post on a blog we started, led to me being a discussant on NPR's Talk of the Nation, talking about the outbreak with Maren McKenna, who I mentioned earlier, and Dev Anderson, who's at Duke, who also does research in this area. So I got to make my point to a national audience, you know, which you don't normally get, you know, just sitting here in Iowa. A couple quick things. I've met colleagues. Mary Dixon Woods is a sociologist who has contributed to the ID Journal Club, the Twit ID chat. Don't know her personally at all, or at least I didn't, but I really liked her work and retweeted it and ended up getting to know her that way and writing an editorial together, and since we've collaborated on other things. So it is social. You can meet new colleagues this way, some that are many thousands of miles away that you wouldn't run into naturally, and publish with them without ever meeting them, which is quite unique. And then the last couple of slides, because obviously I'm speaking to a VA audience, one of the only times I've ever kind of spoken about VA is this instance, which you may be aware of, over the past month or so. Tina Rosenberg, a New York Times columnist in her Opinionator, had contacted me through the blog to comment about success stories in hospital-acquired infections, and I mentioned the VA's MRSA initiative, and got approval through the National Infectious Disease Office and alerted HSR&D that I might be talking to her, and I went ahead and did, and it ended up working out quite well. I obviously had good things to say, and just wanted to quote from this. VA takes care of sicker patients who are at much higher risk for infections, and so this is a confounder. And I really wanted to explain this as a quote from the article. The VA's achievement is even more remarkable because its patients are older and sicker than patients in other hospitals. Most patients are Vietnam-era vets. None are healthy young women giving birth, a large patient group in most hospitals. They are twice as likely to come into the hospital already testing positive for MRSA. And the greater the percentage of people who have the bacteria, the harder it is to control its spread. Because their immune systems are weaker, VA patients are also more likely to go from testing positive to full infection. So, I mean, it's rare that you can kind of explain confounding and why it's a lot harder for VA to prevent these bacteria spreading. And so if we're doing better than other places or even equal, we should be commended. And so it was nice that she picked up on this and we're allowed to kind of explain the science and the barriers actually to control in our VA. And this was picked up, you know, by the Hey VA and many other instances. Here I was quoted on the main VA page there. So it's nice to be able to show a lot of the positive things we're doing in VA to prevent infection and improve quality. And that's not really possible if I'm just publishing papers in my society journal. I needed to get out there and tell our story, which I'm proud of. So a couple final thoughts. Should you blog? If you're passionate about a topic and have co-bloggers, don't do it alone, then I would consider it. It doesn't take a lot of time, and it can be a lot of fun, and I think it makes you a better writer to write all the time. And as far as Twitter, I think it's a no-brainer. I highly recommend it. You don't have to update it. You can use it passively or actively. It can be time-limited, and you can, as I said, you can consume without producing. So it's my last slide, and I do want to thank, this is my research group at the Iowa City VA and University of Iowa, whose science I'm doing my best to get out there, and I love collaborating with them. So thanks very much.
Thank you very much, Dr. Princevich. And Austin, are you ready to share your screen?
Yes, hopefully you can hear me.
Yep, coming through loud and clear, and you should have the pop-up to... There you go.
Okay, we're good to go?
Yep.
Great. Okay, so as was mentioned earlier, if you were here, I'm gonna do a follow-up to a presentation I gave in December of last year, and that presentation is available, and I think on the next slide I have a link to it in case you haven't picked that link up elsewhere. And if you missed it, my guess is that if you're tuning in for this one, you'll want to go back and listen to that one because it was all about using social media, using Twitter, the value of using it, how you might get started, and so on and so forth. Actually, I'll go through that in a second. It was just being evidence-based here. It was a very popular session, but it did generate some questions that I'm going to cover in this talk. And you don't have to have seen the prior presentation to keep up with this one. It's self-contained, but I am responding to questions that came up in comments that I couldn't address during that talk. So here's what I did on that talk, and there's that link up there. If I don't know if you can pluck it off the screen or get back to it later, but if you go to that, you'll find that talk. So last time I kind of had this five-part talk. I talked about do we, meaning the research community, have a communication problem in terms of disseminating what we do, and I showed that, yes, we do have a problem. Then I asked, what can we do about it? And, of course, I had an answer to that question. We can supplement traditional dissemination tactics with social media. So instead of, you know, writing to your congressman or to your local newspaper, writing in a letter, you can also, you know, voice your opinion more publicly through a blog or Twitter and so forth. And I talked about how, I gave some examples about how to do that, how I've done that. Do my crazy ideas work? Well, yes, I wouldn't be talking about them if I thought otherwise, and I think Eli showed some good evidence that you can make some really impressive progress with these methods. You can get your voice heard and your message across. His experience I found it actually very inspirational. I was really impressed, not exactly surprised because I've seen this happen, but really impressed with what he's been able to do. And I want to tell you that he's not the only one, you know, so it's not an isolated case. People like myself as well who really put in the effort to push their message and find ways of communicating it broadly can get through and get access to journalists and newspapers and be on programs, and it's really important, perhaps not for all of us, but at least for some of us to represent the community. So that led to the question, is it right for me? And that really depends. I mean, this is really not for everyone, but I think it's going to be attractive to more people than are doing it, and it's not that hard to get started. And I talked a little bit about how to get started, as did Eli, and I'll come back to that in this talk as well. Okay, so here's my poll question. What percent of studies in healthcare receive any mention in the media? And this is actually a bit of a review from my last talk, and I'm just curious how many people can answer this question.
Thank you. So our audience is already getting started. So for our audience members, again, just click the circle next to your answer option. So the answer choices we have here are 0.04%, 0.4%, or 4%. And these are anonymous answers, so it's okay if you're just taking a wild guess. We'll never know if you got it right or wrong. And it looks like about two-thirds of our audience has voted so far. We'll give people a couple more seconds to get their answers in. All right, I'm going to go ahead and close the poll now, and we'll share those results. Looks like 60% chose option number one, which is 0.04%. 34% answered 0.4%, and 6% guess that 4% of our studies in healthcare receive media attention. So thank you to those respondents.
Okay, so the answer is number one. So randomly a third of you should have selected, but about two-thirds of you did. So either you guys guessed well, or you tuned in, or you just knew the answer. But really the point here is that a shockingly small number of studies that we do or that are done in our field receive any media attention. And that's not to say that they all deserve attention, because some of them are for more internal consumption. Maybe they're on methods or new data or so forth. But some of them really are policy relevant and important for the wider world to know about. And I think it's much more than 0.04%. I think we can do a better job. So my prior talk kind of went through that. So let me get to your questions or your colleagues' questions on my prior talk. And I'm going to go through five of them. People wanted to hear more about VA's social media policy. People wanted more tips for relating to journalists. People wanted to know about how to avoid being misinterpreted. They wanted to know more about Twitter and how to use it. And finally, I was asked what a social media strategy might look like. So I'm going to go through each of these five topics in this talk. Okay, VA's social media policy. So there's a website for this, and here it is, and you can go there. Now, when you go there, when I went there, I was kind of overwhelmed by how much it was really about official VA blogs and official VA social media accounts. So these are blogs and social media accounts, Twitter accounts, that are coming from official VA offices. They're speaking for the VA or for some part of it. And that's not what we're talking about here. That's certainly a topic that one could talk about, but and Eli doesn't talk for the VA. We don't have official VA blogs or VA Twitter accounts. And so you have to dig around that site a little bit to kind of find where they might be talking about people like us. We're VA employees, we're researchers, and we may have or may want to have blogs or Twitter accounts or be on Facebook, and what are kind of the rules of behavior we should have. And I'm not going to go through that in much detail, except just pull out what I thought was the most important thing and the thing that I always think about. And it's in this quote here, which is from a directive that you can find on that site that I have in the first bullet. And it's for personal sites and accounts. VA employees must draw a clear distinction between their personal views and their professional duties. Employees who are not officially authorized to speak on behalf of the VA must never state or imply, it actually says infer, but it means imply, must never state or imply their communications represent VA's official position. So, you know, it's okay to both be a VA employee and a researcher and use social media and talk about research and the research you do, But it's not okay to say or imply that you are representing a VA official position. So I never do that. It sounds like Eli certainly doesn't do that. The time that he wanted to talk about VA research or VA policy, however he characterized it, he actually went through official channels. He said that. He went, I can't remember, but to a communications office, or he went through the program office that he deals with. And that's what I would recommend. If you want to talk about what the VA is doing in any way, go through official channels. If you want to talk about research, which is not necessarily about the VA, certainly not about VA policy, you can go ahead and do that and communicate and of course say that you're not representing the views of the VA. So what I do is, on my blog and my Twitter feed, I don't comment on the VA at all with one exception. I will talk about research, published research in peer-reviewed journals that pertains to the VA. However, I will only discuss the findings of the research. I won't editorialize beyond what the paper says. If the paper makes an editorial statement, I might quote it, but I'm not going to add my own editorialization to that. Oftentimes when I'm talking about anything about the VA in terms of research that's been done, it's my own work. So I'm just promoting my own work, and that's totally fine. The only other caveat I would say is, even if it's my own work, but I know it's a really kind of hot-button political issue, for example, the waiting times issue we had last year. No, I haven't done work on that, but suppose I had. I might decide now is not the time for me to promote my own work. I might do it internally. I might say, you know, and that has been done. My colleagues have done some work, and they've internally had some communication about the waiting times work they've done, because it can be valuable for the organization. But it wasn't a good time for them to kind of wave the flag and saying, hey, we know something about this, because that's drawing attention to themselves and to inviting journalists to come to them where they're going to be tempted to be in a role where they're talking about VA policy when they really shouldn't be, and it's too politically hot. So there's both the official guidance here, and then there's common sense. You know, you work for the VA. It's not your job to talk about policy. Don't stick your foot in where it doesn't belong. That's all I'm going to say about that. So let's move on to number two. The question is, how do I cultivate relationships with journalists? I like to break things down. I actually trained as an engineer. I work as a health economist, but that's not my training. So I always break big problems down into small ones. Start with a few journalists, and maybe not the biggest ones. Don't think you're going to get through to Robert Pear at the New York Times with your first email. You know, follow some on Twitter, or, you know, certainly read their work. And when you see that they're writing in an area that you know something about, or you have something you think kind of fits with what they tend to do, reach out. You know, be helpful. Anticipate their needs. Provide missing pieces, compelling charts, compelling results that they might not be aware of. Do it respectfully. Do it. Make it as easy for them to use as you can. Don't bury them with, you know, 500 words in your first email. Give them a couple sentences and say, contact me for more information, or go here, here's a link. Happy to be of further help. And then don't be disappointed if it doesn't work out, but keep trying. And keep varying your approach. Maybe you think, maybe they didn't listen to me because I didn't make it more plain exactly why it was relevant. Let me try it differently next time. I think it's important to recognize that this is not a trivial investment. Don't give up if, you know, your first 1, 3, 5, 7, 10, 15, 100 emails and tweets don't seem to go anywhere. Take that as maybe implicit feedback that you should change things up, do some more experimentation, but keep trying. The marginal cost is fairly low. The payoff is pretty high if you break through. Okay, so if you're going to talk to journalists, I think one of the biggest concerns that a researcher has is that they're going to be misinterpreted. I want to tell you, I think this concern is way overblown. I don't know where it comes from. Maybe it's a little bit of, well, I'm going to be misinterpreted, so I'm not going to bother. A little self-fulfilling there. But let's distinguish between honest and willful misunderstanding. If it's willful misunderstanding, I actually think, this is a bit paradoxical, I actually think you shouldn't worry about that. If someone really wants to misuse your words and your research, of course you can be offended. Of course you should communicate that, maybe. But I don't think you should worry about it too much, and here's why. Almost everything, maybe everything, that happens in the media is only really in the spotlight, well, to the extent any of it's in the spotlight, and really only a small piece of it is, and usually it's not what we do. It's only for a day or two. It's going to be over. If anybody read that thing that you think was so terrible, they've forgotten it by tomorrow. And the people who are going to remember it, they're your friends. They actually are delighted to see your work represented in this publication. They're outraged like you are that it was misrepresented, and they're going to remember that for a long time because they're your friend or your colleague. But everybody else, if they remember it all, they're going to be like, oh yeah, you were cited in Time magazine or something. That was pretty cool. They're not going to remember the details. Don't sweat it. You're really getting worked up over nothing. That's willful misunderstanding, and that's really a minority of cases. That's really kind of typically, someone who's got an ideological perspective. You know who they are. You're probably not even talking to them. They probably just grabbed your research from someone else and misinterpreted it. It's not your fault. You're not directly quoted. Don't worry about it. Then there's honest misunderstanding. That you should care about, because that's someone who really wanted to get it right and didn't. And you can help them. You can take charge and take some responsibility. You can communicate with them and say, thank you for citing my work. I know you wanted to get it right, and I'm sorry it was slightly, you said it slightly wrong, and here's how. Let me know if you do this, want to talk about it again, and I'll help you get it right. You can do that very politely. You should make the presumption that they weren't trying to make a mistake. If they're doing it based on a conversation with you, not just pulling it out of your research or something someone else said, they've scheduled an interview with you, you can minimize or reduce the risk they're going to misunderstand you by preparing your talking points in advance. This is something I used to do regularly until I got really comfortable talking to journalists, which is, they send me an email, they say, hey, can we talk about this topic or this research? I say, yeah, that's great, schedule time. And before that time comes, I've got my 5 bullet points on a piece of paper printed out in front of me while on the call, so that during the conversation, when one of those bullet points becomes relevant, or I work an answer around to making one of them relevant, I can just look at my page and pretty much read it correctly. That reduces the chances I'm going to misstate something, and that they might mishear something. I send journalists emails before and after clarifying issues. I provide more detail on my own blog. So a lot of times I know I'm going to talk to journalists about an issue, or I've talked to several about an issue, and I can see that there might be a lot more. I'll write a blog post on it, explaining it exactly the way I want. And then the next journalist who calls me or emails me, I send them to that post and say, here, read this first. Maybe it has everything you need. If not, then we can talk. But then they're more educated. And then I can correct journalists on my blog or by Twitter. I can say, I just want to update everyone. There's this great story. It just got this nuance wrong. Here's the right way to say it. Look over here. Okay, the next thing I got was people wanted to know more about Twitter. This is literally what the comment said. Tell me more about Twitter, or pretty close to it. I'm sorry, this is kind of vague. I wasn't really sure what people wanted to know. Hopefully Eli has given, he gave a lot of detail about Twitter. Hopefully that's helpful. All I'd say is you should try it. There's going to be an adjustment period, so it'll be a little bewildering maybe and confusing at first. There's lots of how-to guides out there. You can just Google how to use Twitter, how to get started on Twitter. Here's one that I think has some very good advice. I know that's kind of a mouthful, that URL. It's momthisishowtwitterworks.com. You can read that. Like I said, you can find others. Keep in mind, you only see tweets of those you follow. So Twitter is huge, lots of people, lots of tweets. You're not going to see all of it. You don't want to. Pick the people you want to follow. You're going to find them by Googling their name with the word Twitter, or you can go on Twitter and then do a search. So think of some journalists, some colleagues that you know or suspect might be on Twitter, and go find them. See who they follow. And poke around, try it for a little while, and that's really the best way to do it. Okay, what does a social media strategy look like? This is a tough question. It's really more art than science. I don't think there's one right way. I don't think there's a way that works today that necessarily will work for all time. I think this is just like, you know, using Twitter or communicating to journalists. You have to just keep trying new things till something seems to work. If you're really motivated, you'll do that. You'll find a way to get your message through. So the first rule here is if what you're doing doesn't seem to work, just try something else. Or, you know, if the subject matter doesn't seem to be of interest to folks at the moment, maybe it's the wrong time. Maybe think about doing it when the issue seems to be more salient. You should seek feedback from those who are successful. Maybe you have a colleague or a friend who's kind of more knowledgeable, had more success. You could say, hey, I've been trying this. I'd like to get this message out. How do you think I should do it? Who should I contact? Who should I tweet at? Try those things. And then follow people on Twitter or read blogs and kind of see what they do. Match their style. See what you find engaging and try to emulate it. Then that's it. So hopefully we've been helpful, and here's I tried to answer some of your questions. I think they were better expressed than this this graphic. I hope so, at least. And that's where you can find us.
Excellent. Thanks to both of you. So for our attendees, to submit your questions or comments for our presenters, just use the question section of the GoToWebinar dashboard on the right-hand side of your screen. Click the plus sign next to the word questions, and that'll expand it, and you can submit your question or comment. We'll get to them in the order that they are received. If it's for Eli or Austin in particular, please note that when I read it aloud. The first question from our audience, do either of you use SocialMed?
This is Austin. Let me first say, sorry, Eli, for not putting your blog title on this. I didn't actually realize what it was. So maybe you can just remind everyone, but I didn't mean to leave that off. I was just didn't know. Anyway, I don't use SocialMed. I don't even know what it is. Eli, do you know?
No, I do not.
All right. No problem. So, Austin, you kind of covered this. Maybe you could go over it real quick again. So when you're talking, do you need permission from the VA to blog about any of this? So I think that means not under official VA account.
I don't blog or tweet or do anything under an official VA account. I don't have one. So everything is just me as a researcher who happens to be employed by the VA and as a citizen. And I don't filter myself too much, except I don't discuss VA policy. And when I talk about VA issues, it's only what's been published in the research literature, and then I tend not to editorialize beyond what's there. And I also avoid any subject that's controversial about the VA right now. I just keep my head down when things are hot because I don't want to get mixed up, and I don't want people to think I'm speaking for the VA when I am not.
Thank you. That submitter also writes that they are not able to send anything out of their VA without the media specialist's approval first, and that seems to be the prudent route to take if you want to.
So, if you want to talk about VA related stuff, that's correct. I would agree with that. If you want to talk about the work of your field, you don't need to do that, and you would be wasting a lot of people's time, including your own, to do that. You want to talk about the latest research in health economics, health services research, infectious disease, whatever it is, it has nothing to do with VA policy per se. You're talking about research finding, research methods, maybe policy relevant in some way, but it's not about VA policy. Directly, you should do that. You're a knowledgeable researcher who has something to provide the world, and we should be disseminating the work that the community does. And we don't need a media office to approve that kind of communication. And I don't think if you look at the VA policy that I put a link to, it's not suggesting that you do. As a individual who reads research, consumes it and understands it, you can talk about it.
Thank you for that reply. Eli, this question came in when you were speaking. Can you talk a little bit about hashtags, what they mean, how to follow them, what trending is?
So hashtags, it's just the, you know, the pound sign, the hash sign before a term. I use them. You can go up. There's a search bar in the upper right corner on the website, but, you know, if you use it on your phone or a tablet or something like that, it might be in a different place. But you can search a hashtag and a term like ID week, the meeting, or vaccine debate or something like this. And you'll see, when you search that, you'll see all the tweets, initially top 10 trending tweets, and then you can click and see all tweets that have mentioned that subject recently or used that hashtag. Sometimes, like if I wrote MRSA in a tweet, I don't hashtag it, and you can find it just by searching MRSA. You don't have to use hashtags, but it's one nice way to follow something that people are talking about. So for the meeting ID week, if you follow hashtag ID week during the meeting, everyone will use that hashtag in their tweets that wants you to easily see what they're talking about in relationship to the meeting. I think trending is just some statistical analysis Twitter does and publishes about what topics, what hashtags people are using at that moment or that hour. So it's just a way of for people to keep up on what's popular in the moment.
Thank you. Somebody did want to mention that hashtag HCSM is healthcare social media, so that might be a good place for somebody to start if they are interested. Austin, can you talk about secure and unsecured tweets and blogs? How do you go about this?
Not totally sure what that means.
Do you do all of yours unsecured, or does that limit their accessibility to anyone?
You mean like password protected?
Well, I think there's this, you can be a secured Twitter thing where the only people that can follow you are people that you approve.
Oh, private.
Think?
Yeah, you can have a private Twitter account where you have to approve anyone who wants to follow you. So if someone wants to follow you, you'd get like a notification or an email, and you could say, yeah, I approve, Eli, you can follow me now. So mine is not a private account because that really limits who can follow me. I don't have any need to limit that. I don't mind. Anyone who wants to follow me is totally fine. And for a blog, you know, my blog, I blog in four different places. Three of them I don't control, New York Times, JAMA, and Academy Health. I just provide content, and those are all open to everyone. My own blog is as well. I'm an editor, editor-in-chief there, and I don't want to limit it because my interest is having as wide an audience as possible, or at least allowing anybody who's interested to find it.
Thank you. This is just a little anecdote from one of our attendees. This person is at Tina, the AUD. I just attended a conference last week and uploaded a photo of us at our booth. I included a quick disclaimer, opinions are my own, or something along those lines. Nobody has dinged me yet. I'm still waiting. Thank you for that comment. So the next person writes, and I think this might be a little more referring to the blogging, but I'm not sure. This sounds very time-consuming. How do you find the additional time to do this type of upkeep, given all the needs that occur within a day?
Yeah, that's a good question. So I think it's all, you know, whatever you invest time in, you get returns, and Austin mentioned that nicely in his talk. So, you know, everything that you invest in, so I can read the literature inefficiently or efficiently with Twitter, things like this. So you get payback. As far as blogging, so Twitter can take no time, or, you know, you could waste your whole life on it, but if you just set yourself 15 minutes today, I'll look at Twitter, it'll only take 15 minutes. And if you follow people appropriately, you know, that are in your field, narrowly defined, it doesn't take very much time to keep up with your day, what happened. As far as blogging, that could take a lot of time, but you're not writing 5,000-word tomes. You're writing 250-word quick thoughts on the latest article or 400 words, and you get very quick, at responding and doing it the more you do it. So it used to take me an hour to write a post back in 2009, and now it'll take 15 minutes or 10 minutes. And if you post one or two times a week, it's not a big commitment. And I think the payoff is really there. But it does take time. Everything of value, you know, you got to put something into it.
Yeah, to send a tweet, that's one click. So my philosophy about tweeting is if I've read something and I've taken the time to read it, I might as well take another second to share it. I use Google Chrome, and there's a button that I have installed, and I can just with one click send it out, and it'll capture the title and the URL, and it sends it out. Or if I want to express a thought on Twitter, you know, I have to compose that. It'll take a little more time. So actually disseminating through Twitter is very, very fast. Keeping up with Twitter, well, that's, as Eli said, that can take as much time or as little time as you want. On busy days, I do almost none of it. When I have time, I'll skim more of it. There's always things of value there. I don't have time. None of us has time to consume everything of value that we might come across. So, you know, if I want to put in 15 minutes, I'll find a few things of value that I might read. And if I don't do that, I just won't. I'm too busy. I have other things to do. Blogging takes more time, but it doesn't have to take, you know, you shouldn't think of every blog post as being like a perfectly constructed, you know, Nietzsche perspective article. A blog post can literally be a quote. You can extract a paragraph from a paper you thought was very interesting. You could just dump the abstract and the link of the paper on your blog. If you've got some followers who trust you for a specific area or specific kind of expertise, you're communicating to them that this is of value. And if you want to add a sentence or two, you can. But that, a blog post can be that simple, and it can take a few minutes. If you want to write more, you'll be motivated to do it. I mean, I write, you know, because I'm passionate about something, and I choose my topics that way. So, you know, if I find I don't say, here's something everybody else is talking about in healthcare that's important. I should write something about that. I never set myself up for that. That's a setup for failure. I could probably write the piece, but it'll take me 4 hours. What I do instead is, oh, this is intriguing, this thing I've just, you know, noticed, or people are, maybe they're talking about it, maybe they're not. I read it in an article. I'm really motivated to read about this and then try to express what it is I find interesting as a way of thinking through the issue myself. And then I don't mind the time spent on it because I'm really excited about it.
Thank you both for those replies. The next question, I've encountered situations where the local VA PAO has blocked me from discussing my research with journalists. It sounds from what you are saying as though they should not be able to do that. Do you have advice for how we can respond or educate the local PAO about our ability to discuss our published disseminated research if it was VA funded?
So I'm not sure how to answer this. It's my feeling that one ought to be able to respond to inquiries about one's research. But that's what I think is right. That doesn't necessarily mean that's your as a VA employee, you have that right. I've never been blocked from doing so. And in fact, every communication I've got is that the VA wants me to communicate, you know, the research that I've done. So I think this is worth a discussion. I'm not sure I'm the right person to discuss it with. In fact, perhaps CIDR could help with this, the folks who have put on this cyber seminar.
Thank you. Eli, do you want to add anything to that?
No, I have the same feeling as Austin. I wish that we all could, but I don't know what the best approach is to answer that question.
Okay. Thank you. I can do a little digging around here. I know the person who submitted the question, so we can follow up offline. Let's see. So for professionals like us, which social media is good to publish the articles? Facebook, Twitter, journals?
All right. So I have some opinions about this. depends a little bit what you're trying to do, but don't go to Facebook to try to easily find the journalists or policymakers or their staff who you're trying to interface with. Facebook is really is kind of the emphasize the social part of social media. It's a great place to go to catch up with your high school friends, or you have a high school reunion coming up, or to keep up with what's going on in your community or so forth. Very social. But I'm not sure, well, in fact, I know it's not the place that journalists and increasingly academics are connecting. There you should go to Twitter. Now, if you want to write something of length, you can't do that easily on Twitter directly, right? Tweets are short. You can string a few together, but ultimately you're going to have to reference something longer by URL, and then you have to put that text somewhere. Maybe it's 500 words or whatever it is. You could certainly put that text on Facebook. I've seen people do that. You can use Facebook as a really kind of a, you know, for lack of a better term, like a poor man's blog. You can dump very long things on Facebook and then link to them from Twitter. Or you can go get a blog, a free one on Blogger or elsewhere, or put it anywhere you can online. The point is it has to have a URL, and then you can point people to it on Twitter.
Thank you. Eli, do you have a strong opinion one way or the other?
Yeah, I think Twitter is the place to be for academic discussions.
Thank you. The next, these are a couple comments. I've also found value in vlogs, which are video blogging. Do either of you have any experience or opinions on that?
So my co-editor-in-chief, Aaron Carroll at the Incidental Economist, he does twice a week video blog called Healthcare Triage, and they're posted right on our blog. You can get them on YouTube and subscribe. They're great because he's great, and he's working with the a bunch of producers who do great work, so it's very professional. That's the only one I actually consume regularly, so I can't really speak to the genre in general. I don't generally watch videos. They take a lot of time. I listen more to podcasts. Occasionally I'll convert a video to an audio only so I can listen to it. So that's my comment on that.
Eli, did you want to add anything to that?
Nothing to add. No, it's a very niche product, and right, I think to do it well, you have to do it like Aaron Carroll does.
I guess I'd add, Aaron and I also ran a podcast that we disseminated through the blog going back a few years. We did it for a number of months. I can't remember how many we did, maybe a dozen or so. We stopped doing it because you know, they were about 20 minutes each. I think when you put all put it all together, it probably took us you know, an hour or so in total to do it. But we weren't getting that many followers or subscribers. It was kind of hard to promote. I've noticed if there's anything people do not click through or share on Twitter, it's podcasts. Forget about it. I can't get any. It might be the greatest audio, you know, 15 minutes I've ever heard in my life. I can't get anyone to listen. I listen to a lot of podcasts, and it kind of frustrates me because there's good stuff out there. So the lesson is, if you like them, go ahead and consume them. I don't think it's the first place I'd put my effort if I want to disseminate. I think I'd start with blogs in Twitter, the written word. It's easier. It's easier for people to skim and to quote and share.
Thank you. One person does have one suggestion for a good video blogger. First of all, learning to do it in a one-minute type video gets your research to a lot of people, and maybe to consume your written contact. Facebook will also prioritize your video and picture content. Somebody who does a good job, e.g. Craig Bryan, has published some very important studies through the National Center for Veterans Studies, and one of his videos got over 17,000 views.
That's so very good.
I guess it is possible out there.
Wow. Yeah, it's possible.
Somebody else writes in, policymakers typically have three Facebook accounts. You need to find out which account they use and for what if you want to get their attention. Interesting.
I will say sometimes it's hard to find the right account on Twitter, particularly if someone has a fairly common name. You know, David Smith, good luck. Very hard. You usually have to ask them directly if you can. This occasionally is problematic for me. I'd say it's a very small percentage of the time, but sometimes I'm looking for someone and I kind of give up because I just can't quite be sure I'm finding the right handle.
Thank you. Somebody else writes in, another thing to note about Facebook is many people do use it for their personal social lives. So if you do blend in professional work, then you are inviting your colleagues into your personal realm.
So. Yeah, that's getting mixed on all social media these days, and that's true of Twitter too. You can have two accounts and try to keep things separate. I don't personally bother. I'm as personal as I will get on social media through my single account, which means I'm actually, you know, I draw the line. I don't post photos of my family and, talk about very many intimate details. But I do mix it up because it's also a way to let off steam. I also think people who follow me professionally also want to get to know me personally and vice versa. And so, I'm happy when someone mixes in some personal stuff or they're just frustrated at something and they blow off some steam. It can be entertaining. I think that's okay.
Thank you. Somebody wrote in, I agree, you need a personable professional presence. You just have to behave as a small town professional does, be a real person, but keep the very personal stuff off. Thank you. For our presenters, that is the last of the questions. I want to give you a chance to make any concluding comments you'd like to our audience. Eli, do you have anything you'd like to wrap up with?
Just hope to see you all on Twitter, and thanks very much.
Great.
Yeah, I agree. If anybody joins Twitter because of this presentation, just say so on Twitter. Just tell me and perhaps Eli, hi, I saw your cyber seminar, and now I'm on Twitter. Then we'll know.
And I'm just going to plug it and say add the tiny URL to the archive of this presentation. Excellent. Well, thank you so much for both of our presenters for lending your expertise to the field. And, of course, thank you to our attendees for joining us. I am going to close the meeting in just a second. Or when you close out yourself, please wait just a second while a feedback survey pops up. Obviously, we do read your questions and comments very closely, and it helps us decide which future sessions to coordinate and have presented. So thank you once again to everybody for joining us, and this does conclude today's HSR&D Cyber Seminar presentation. Have a great day.